I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On April 2nd, that's coming up this week, PBS is presenting RX, The Quiet Revolution. It's a look at doctors and caregivers from Alaska to Maine, Mississippi to San Francisco, who are reinventing the patient-medical-caregiver relationship and actually improving the health and well-being of their patients. There are even, surprise of surprises, doctors who do house calls. I remember those doctors back when I was a child. The film is by veteran PBS producer and filmmaker director David Gruben, who is the son of a general practitioner. He is joining us this hour, along with Dr. David Lochsterkamp, who is from Belfast, Maine, and he's been practicing medicine in that community for some 30 years. The film actually begins with the doctor riding a scooter in the town making a house call. But it looks at diabetes rates in the Mississippi Delta. It looks at an alternative to nursing homes for Chinese in Chinatown in San Francisco, and Native Americans taking control of their own health care with an elaborate system of health care that gets to very, very remote parts of Alaska. It's a very, very well-done documentary, and we're happy to talk about it this hour of the program. David Gruben is a director, writer, producer who's produced over 100 films, history, art, poetry, science. He's won every award in the field of documentary TV, and he has done biographies for The American Experience, Abraham and Mary Lincoln, A House Divided, LBJ, Truman, Teddy Roosevelt, the story of Teddy Roosevelt, and FDR. And he's done a 5-part series for PBS, Healing and the Mind with Bill Moyers. And we're very happy, David, to have you with us. Hi, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, our pleasure. Dr. David Lochsterkamp is also joining us from, I assume, Belfast, Maine. Is that where you are, doctor?
I am, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. He's been doing medicine for 30 years in the same community, knows everybody in town, they all know him, and does house calls and has a really neat system of health care where people can go and get the services of dietitians and psychologists, and they've taken on issues recently like opioid addiction in the community. Thank you very much for being with us. Well, I just found the film to be so inspirational, really, and interesting, David. It was so good to know that there are models of healthcare where the patient really is front and center, and people seem to care so much about what they're doing.
Well, I'm glad you liked it and that you saw it that way. I did not want to make a film about the broken healthcare system or about Obamacare and those sort of things. You know, people have drawn up their sides on that. There's so much coverage. And what I was interested in was looking at solutions, mm-hmm. People who are doing extraordinary work, institutions doing extraordinary work, and it was an awful lot of fun to approach the subject that way.
Oh, I imagine. You went to some extraordinary places. And your father was a doctor, wasn't he?
He was a doctor. He was a general practitioner, old school, kind of like David, Dr. Lochsterkamp's father. And that was kind of an inspiring thing because when I looked at my father at work as a boy, when I was a boy and I saw that black bag, I thought it was filled with all kinds of wonders. But in fact, he didn't have that much there. But what he did have was he had, let's call it the schmooze factor. He loved to be with his patients. He cared about his patients, and that mattered. Uh-huh. And that's something we've lost, I feel, as we've gained in the scientific revolution in medicine. And I was glad to see that the equation is getting rebalanced.
Mm-hmm. And it's so true in your community of Belfast, Dr. Lochsterkamp, where you must know virtually everybody in town, and certainly everybody knows you.
Well, I've been here 30 years, and it surprises me when I go to the supermarket how many people I don't recognize. It's a changing community. It's a wonderful community. But I do know a lot of folks, and the hard part of this stage of my practice is that many of the people I've known for 20, 25, 30 years are now at that point in their life where they're getting sick and dying, and so every patient who takes a downward turn is a friend of mine. That makes it hard. But on the other hand, I practice with a great group of colleagues who we buoy each other up. We give each other support. We recognize how hard it is to practice medicine, and in part, that's why we've collected around each other and created the practice we have.
Mm-hmm. And be it the Mississippi Delta or Belfast, Maine, or San Francisco Chinatown, or Native Americans in Alaska, one thing that seems to hold true of all that you highlight, David, is really a focus on the patient and how people gather to look at the patient and what the patient's needs are. A whole team of people do that. It really focuses on the individual, which in many ways seems pretty absent from a lot of healthcare today.
Well, it's something we all want. We all want our doctors, our healthcare professionals to listen. But it's also very good for us because chronic illness is something that one out of every two Americans have. And one out of every four Americans have two or more chronic illnesses. And when you have a chronic illness, you have to take care of your own health. And the doctor's role is to help you do that, to partner with you. But if the doctor, if you don't feel your doctor cares about you, then why are you going to care about yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And it, so it really is a critical factor in treatment. And I actually learned that from David Loxerkamp.
You know, it's interesting, of all the doctors I've known in my lifetime and been to, the only name that I can vividly remember is Dr. Rothenberg, who came to the house in Des Plaines, Illinois, back when I was a kid many, many years ago, and I remember him vividly. Isn't that interesting? And I remember some doctors from more recently, but that's the name that stays with me. He made a huge impression when I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
We sometimes have that opportunity to, at a critical moment in a person's life, create a bond that lasts forever. I've delivered babies in Belfast for 25 years, and I still have mothers come up to me in the supermarket and you know, with a gangling 18-year-old boy and say, this is the doctor who delivered you. And, of course, oftentimes it's hard for me to remember, but they remember distinctly.
Oh, sure.
Being with people at a critical moment in their life is so rewarding and creates a bond that provides a lot of moral authority for later opportunities for helping them, say, with a bad marriage or a severe depression or something like that.
Mm-hmm. We get to see you at work quite a bit in this film, and it's really a wonderful depiction of who you are as a doctor and what it is you're dealing with. What's interesting to me is that you really can identify what some of the, like the opioid addiction in Belfast, you're responding to a health crisis, but also that you really respond in a pretty non-judgmental way, very non-judgmental way, and seem to be concerned, really, about all of the people who you're seeing. If they can't come to you for whatever reason, you will come to them, and you just seem to be nonplussed if there were cats jumping in your face or whatever the situation was. You really cared about the person.
This is the wonderful thing about community, whether it's a community in an urban environment or where we have it here in Belfast, is that there is this sense of interdependency. That is, my children's teachers or their children or my patients in need of recovery from an addiction of some kind or another. We see the interconnectedness. We see that that these are my children who come to me for care, whether it be for a strep throat or opioid addiction. And that's a wonderful thing about community life, is that we know we depend on each other in this community. So I see it as an opportunity to help. I see it as an opportunity that really in our community no one else is providing. So we really had this chance. I think it's an honor to step in and provide this kind of care for young people who have made bad choices, yes, but also came from circumstances that made it almost impossible for them to make good choices. So I relish the opportunity. I work with a group of colleagues who similarly believe that this is part of our civic responsibility, our community responsibility. I think, Kathleen, that one of the great aspects of David's film is that he shows that each community that he visited responded to the particular needs of their community
yes.
in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really the bottom line. That is, there cannot be a rubber stamp that says this is how we're going to cure the ills of the country. In every community, there is a different kind of need or a different way to respond that's going to be more effective than if you would apply those same techniques or that same protocol in another community.
Right.
So, David hit the nail on the head. He found unique ways, special ways, that each community came together to address the health care needs of that particular time and place.
Yeah, and we'll go back to Belfast, but let's go to some of those other communities, David. The Mississippi Delta, where diabetes rates are, I believe, the highest in the nation.
That's right, that's right. And what I found there was a healthcare clinic that was using the technology to help stay in touch with their patients, but the goal of the technology was to allow the patient to become accountable for their own health. And that's finally what these chronic diseases need. If you have diabetes, you have to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so with a technology that allows you to take your blood every day, send it 2 hours away from where we were to Jackson and Mississippi, the capital, and to have people there monitoring it, looking at it, getting back to you, it made for a dialogue that was rewarding for the patient because they felt that people cared about them.
And
bottom line.
Meeting Annie Ford through your film made me want to put her on national television every day, and the rate of diabetes would go way down in this country, don't you think?
Well, yeah, that's a lady who really felt if you know, someone's going to care about me, I'm going to work with them. And that's really what I saw everywhere. And to follow up with what David was saying, what I liked about doing the film was that it was saying that there's a revolution going on out there to change healthcare, but it's coming from the grassroots.
Mm.
And it's beyond politics because it begins someplace we can all begin. How can doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals, how can they help people live better, longer, more productive lives?
And
how can they do that? That's what the politics should grow out of. And we always start from you know, it's just like we're starting from the top, and is it Obamacare? Let's start with what is going to make doctors better doctors,
mm-hmm.
patients healthier,
mm-hmm.
and then figure out what policies will do that.
You make the point, and I don't think that we've thought about this very much in our society, that there is this huge baby boom generation, and in not too many years, we're going to have a lot of people in this country who are very old. And I would imagine that many of those people, like many of the Chinese that you interviewed in Chinatown, want to stay in their own homes. And they've done a really interesting thing in Chinatown for a certain part of the population that wants to stay at home. Can you talk about that?
Well, it is amazing because if you ask 94% of Americans, they want to go to a nursing home when they're frail and elderly,
right.
and really can't care for them, they say no. And they say, like my mother said, whatever you do, don't put me in a nursing home.
Right.
I'd rather die than go to a nursing home. What's the answer? What do you want? They want to stay in their own homes. They want to be independent. Well, okay, there's an organization in Chinatown that for 40 years has been taking care of people in their own homes. They do their shopping for them. They do their laundry. They do their they bring the meds to them. They cook for them. And they take them in vans to a senior center so that they can be with their friends. It's a complicated operation, but they've worked it out. They listen to what their patients needed, what these elderly people needed, and they responded.
And in Alaska, which is an amazing story because Native Americans had to take back the healthcare system, right?
That is an amazing story because the Indian Health Service was treating Native Alaskans in Anchorage in an emergency room, and nobody was happy with it. And what we show in the film is how the Native Alaskan people took the system back and then built it into a marvelously effective system, treating 65,000 patients over 100,000 square miles.
Oof.
Quite something. And it's a place where people come to study from all over the world, to study this system, to see how they did it,
mm-hmm.
how they do it.
Yeah, it's a great story. Doctor, let me go to you for a moment. One of the things that you must find frustrating, and or at least I found frustrating as I watched the film, was that you did have some patients who this model requires people to take care of themselves. And I must say, you did have some patients who you were very nice to them, but it looked as though they weren't taking health care in their own hands. And I'm wondering how people in the medical profession can move that along so that people will look at preventive care and what they can do to prevent heart disease and diabetes, et cetera. And once they're in your office, how you can move people who may be severely overweight, very diabetic, to change their lives substantially. It's a difficult thing to do.
Well, it is. And I think there are a couple of things I would say, Kathleen. First of all, it's always been my approach that the relationship comes first, that they need to know that I care about them first. Mm. And I'm not here to badger them, criticize them, judge them, dismiss them. I'm here to help them. Mm. And so to establish some kind of a common bond, a common relationship, where they know ultimately that I really care about their outcome. Secondly, I would say that for probably 25% of my diabetics, they don't take any medication. They maybe came in with high blood sugars, were overweight, were eating poorly. They understood what they needed to do. They took they ran with it. They're doing fine without any medications. I basically monitor them once a year and say, you're doing a great job.
Hmm.
The people like you saw in David's film really have many times poor education, low self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
They've lost a purpose for living.
Hmm.
And my job is, over a period of time, to try to help them understand why they need to be healthy, what's in it for them, what of their values link them to better health. It's really a process of both understanding them better and waiting for the right time that will affect the change. You know, it may be coming out of the emergency room. It may be a wound infection. It may be a situation where they develop pneumonia. And at that moment, they might be opening to listen to a different way of caring for themselves and to eating better or whatever. Sometimes I'm not the person who can reach them. And so this is why we, in our practice, we have an RN care manager, a dietitian, psychologist, a psychiatrist, a behavioral therapist. We have various people who, you know, I'll try to encourage them to listen to. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, David in the film showed people who are more challenging. And,
right.
You know, if everyone was a success story, you know, I would be out of business. So I understand that with the people in the film, I'm going to stick with them no matter what. They know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that matters. I think with certain people, they need to have a father figure. Certain people need to have a consultant. Certain people need to have, you know, a different kind of doctor. I try to be those things to whatever that person needs that day, whatever voice they need to hear that day. But it's a complicated process. And the wonderful thing about family medicine is that, you know, we're in it for the long haul. We have this continuity over sometimes decades to try to help people. We don't have to fix it that night in the emergency department. I have a great deal of respect for emergency room doctors who have to get the final answer in a matter of, you know, 20 minutes or 30 minutes. I have a longer period of time to get to know the patient, understand their values, and help them see how those values link to a better and healthier lifestyle.
Mm. Well, you do it very well. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. We're talking about A Quiet Revolution in Healthcare and a film that will be on PBS this Thursday. It's titled RX, The Quiet Revolution. And we're speaking with the director, writer, and producer, David Gruben, who's done many, many highly acclaimed award-winning films for PBS. He's won a ton of awards. He looks at Belfast, Maine, and the doctor. We're also speaking with Dr. David Loxterkamp, who's been doing primary care doctoring, including house calls. He arrives on a scooter frequently, if the weather's nice, to treat patients who can't make it to the clinic. It also looks at diabetes care in the Mississippi Delta, alternatives to nursing homes in Chinatown, and a revamping of the entire healthcare system in Alaska. So that's what we're talking about this hour, and welcoming your phone calls if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. We'll be with your phone calls and messages in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for our guests. 800-486-8655 is the number, and our first caller is Randy in Reedsburg. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Thank all of you for what you do for people. I want to relate this story. 25 years ago, I had been hospitalized for a week, in my 40s, and was looking at everything changing and wrong. And my doctor, before he left sort of my exit conference that day, by the way, this doctor has just retired, he put his arm around me. I practiced telling you this story without becoming emotional, by the way. He put his arm around me, and he said, "This is not your fault." And a lot of it had been my fault. And what that did, he then turned, he said, "You know how we could handle this?" And I just said, "What do I need to do?" And the way he expressed concern, I probably would not have survived, certainly not in any reasonable way, but certainly not now. But I thrive now, and, of course, in conjunction with things at the UW, which don't cut the funds to the UW Medical School, and a local family doctor that just cared. There's nothing like that. This man's daughter now is a doctor, and I have so wanted, I don't know where she practices, but I'd like to write down the comments to her sometime that her dad made to me, that she probably grew up with hearing, and relate them, and I don't know her address. But, when you said it's the caring, he was a great physician and scientist, this family doctor, but the way he communicated care, when a lot of the world doesn't care at any given time, you know, but boy, that made a difference for me.
Sounds like he was a great man as well, and I'm so glad you called. Actually, he sounds like you, Dr. Loxterkamp, that kind of doctor, don't you think? I mean, what you hope to be, and from what I saw in the film, who you are.
Thank you for saying so. We all hold that out as the goal, and we have better days and worse days. I just want to say that in my experience as a teacher, we get a number of students coming into our practice, second-year medical students. I see a bright future for American medicine in those caring eyes. Unfortunately, there's a lot that keeps our attention away from the patient. Computers, meaningful use, pay for performance, and all the other quote-unquote incentives that we have to do quote-unquote better medicine. You know, our first job is really the patient in the room, trying to understand what they're communicating with us today, listening to them, and showing that we care about the outcome of whatever they brought to us that day.
Mm. That was quite a phone call, wasn't it, Randy? I think that you met people, patients, who have similar stories to Randy's.
What it made me think of was talking to the dean at the Hofstra North Shore LIJ Medical School, and he said to me, "You know, we try to tell our students that when they're doctors, their patients
aren't going to know whether they graduate first in their class in nephrology or, you know, that they ace
right.
the test in rheumatism. But they won't know even if you're a good diagnostician. But every patient will have an exquisite sense of whether you care about them.
Absolutely.
And I said to her, well, you know, does that help? And he said, yeah, because they'll follow your advice then.
How true. You don't want to let him down. I like you. And you're on my side. That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Randy. What a call. Thank you. Heather in Bloomer. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show. I would like to speak to a young man who happens to be in his 80s, a physician, a family physician from the Chippewa Falls area. He is an absolutely remarkable man. He still makes house calls.
Hmm.
He works. In fact, he just got back from a trip, I believe it was to Central America, where he helps people down there. He has started free clinics.
Hmm.
He is. He happened to be the triage doctor when our Marine barracks 20 years ago was attacked.
Oh, my.
He is, I guess... I am so fortunate to call him friend.
Mm.
He's still out there. He's much like the doctors that you have on your show.
Mm-hmm.
And I would call him my hero.
Mm.
At this point, he advocates for, as he calls it, Mother Earth.
Thank you so
remarkable, much. Remarkable
yeah.
man.
Do you want to say his name, or should you not?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Thomas, yeah, okay. Dr. Thomas Chisholm.
Dr. Thomas Chisholm.
Yes, from Chippewa Falls.
Wonderful. Here's to you, Doctor. And to you.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Thank you very much. Do you find, though, Dr. Loxterkamp and David, that we're calling out heroes because they're rare among us. Is your practice, I mean, for heaven's sake, you start the film driving a scooter on your house call, Dr. Loxterkamp. When I saw it, I thought, this is terrific, but are there many people like this? Are we moving more in that direction, or are we facing a shortage of just any doctors who are in small towns? Dr. Loxterkamp?
Well, you know that we are facing that kind of a shortage. To some extent, the ranks are being filled with so-called mid-level practitioners, nurse practitioners and physician assistants. But we also need family doctors, general internists, generalist pediatricians to come to small communities and even to urban areas, to the central city, to take care of patients. I look to David and this film showing that not only is idealism alive and well, but that it can be done with a good business plan. That is, these are successful operations, some helped by grants, but by and large, we are surviving in this kind of a climate. So I always hesitate to think of the doctor as a hero, calling anyone a hero, because, or a saint, because what it does is it says, well, you know, you're much better at this, you do it. We all have a job to play. We all have a role to play in looking around our community and saying, wherein lies the problem, and what can I do to make it better? And it takes really in a community like Belfast, like any of these communities, it takes not just the doctor, but it also takes all the other components coming together, including the patients, who once empowered can become a vocal and a changing part of the practice, who can come in and provide leadership in a practice, who can volunteer their time, who can contribute their ideas, and most importantly, who can take responsibility for their own care. So I see it as a community effort. I appreciate what the caller had to say. I went into family medicine because of my father. A big part of why David did this film was because of his father. These were our heroes,
right.
But more on a personal level because of they were our parents, our fathers. But we also can see, we also saw through this film how it really is a whole community that makes for better health.
Well, let me ask you, David, this way. Did you have all kinds of possibilities for filming, or did you have just a few?
Well, I called the film A Quiet Revolution because I saw all over the country practices like David's or like the one in Mississippi. Yes, it really, you know, along the lines of what we're talking, I grew up in the 50s. In the 50s, doctors were heroes. They were the second, I think, most trusted people in the country after Supreme Court justices. And this is true. And, you know, this is what's changed, and we've lost faith in the medical community because I think this human touch has kind of went out of it as we gained in all kinds of scientific advances. Now I think it's turning around. So I saw everywhere these idealistic practices, but following up on what David said, what's different is that the doctor now isn't a single hero leading from the front. He's part of a team. David has a team practice.
Right.
And all of the practices that I feature in the film are teams. And what that means is that not only do you have a number of eyes looking at the problem and sharing whatever the illness is, but it's also it's a sharing of the emotional burden. My father had to take it all on himself as a hero, where today I see that the doctor can share with the physician assistant, with the behavioral psychologist in the office, the pharmacist, and I think that's a huge and important shift.
Mm-hmm. You see, at the end of the film, if only my father could have seen this film, what would he have said? What would he have thought?
I think he would have felt inspired because he would have felt, when he left practice, I think he was feeling medicine was going in the wrong direction. And I think I'm saying to him in this film, that idealism that inspired you to get into medicine, inspired, I think, most doctors to practice. It's coming to the forefront now, and you're going to feel good about it, and also you're going to understand, Dad, that I understand you better. I understand how tough it is to be a doctor, and how good you are we're at it.
And Dr. Loxner-Camp, what about your father? What would he have said?
Well, I wish I knew. My dad died when he was 49.
Oh.
He had a heart attack.
Mm.
He dealt with his stress in ways that he could have made better choices. The practice, which he gave his whole heart to, was hard on him, taxed him, taxed the family. I think he would say, thank God you have the support you need. I think that's what he would say to me.
Mm.
And I would say, you know, I feel like I have the support of my patients. I feel like I have the love of my community, but I also have the necessary support of colleagues who will pick you up after a hard day, if there's been a mistake, if there's been a bad outcome, if a friend of yours is taken sick and died. There's others who will come and shore you up, and, you know, that's something that he didn't have. He didn't have anyone to be his mentor. He didn't have anyone to be his collegial friend, and that takes a toll.
I'm sure.
I think contributed to his shorter life.
Mm. Let's go back to phone calls. Peter in Wausau. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Kathleen, thank you for taking my call. David and Doctor. And Doctor, I'm sorry for the loss of your father at such an early age. Listening to this program, though, it just reminded me kind of a horror story. I do criminal defense work, and I was involved in a case with a very young mother, a single woman. She had a child that was born premature, and when finally released from the hospital, she was given instructions to bring the child back in a month, essentially for a wellness check. But a month later was mid-February or later, and she didn't bring the child. And she ended up charged criminally for criminal negligence or child neglect.
Mm.
And I was so infuriated because the idea that this woman who didn't have a car, didn't have a driver's license, didn't have money for cab fare, was somehow supposed to bundle this very young, very vulnerable child up and take her to the hospital when all I could remember as a kid was my doctor, whose name I still remember, Dr. Eli Epstein in Milwaukee, coming to me at my home. Mm-hmm. He was well. He was fit. He was healthy. He had the means. And it just was so infuriating that they had this idea that her not bringing this child in was somehow criminally negligent, and all I could see was what they were requiring of her was criminal recklessness. Mm-hmm. And I did finally get them to see it my way, and we resolved it favorably, but just the idea that we would even be there was frustrating. And so the idea that there is this revolution going on in the system that is taking things in a more sensible direction is heartwarming.
Oh, what a story that is. Dr. Luxterkamp, you want to respond to that?
Sure. I think really in the last probably 5 or 10 years, we have in the medical profession come to realize that the social determinants of health play as large or even larger role in many people's lives as does all of the pills and procedures that I prescribe or order. And this unfortunate woman was asked to, first of all, come back a month later. Now, upon hospital discharge, the rule is 2 or 3 days that they were, you know, the goal is to get them in within a couple of days into the office. We also have a new entity called care management. The goal of care management is to address all of those reasons why that patient could not have come back to the office or could not return
right.
to the office.
Right, yeah.
Lack of transportation, insurance, whatever it is. And I think that that's a real turning point for medicine. If there's going to be one thing that comes out of the so-called patient-centered medical home, it'll be our strong attention to those social determinants and help for the doctor to do what I can do medically, but also what is necessary to be done for that patient in getting them to the doctor and getting their health insurance and making sure that they have heat in their apartment and mold not growing on their walls and so forth. All of those things are so essential, and I hope that the days described by your caller are long behind us.
Mm. Are they, David Grubin?
I think that is really changing. That's a horror story.
It is.
And in the places that I saw, that couldn't have happened because the doctors and the healthcare systems are right on top of it. They're not blaming their patients.
Mm-hmm.
They feel it's their responsibility to be listening to their patients and to be, oh, that patient didn't come in. We better call them. They wouldn't let that happen. What's amazing to me is I saw, you know, doctors that would say to their patients, you didn't take your pills. Well, why? And then the patient said, well, they were too big. I couldn't swallow them.
No.
I couldn't afford the food that I needed to take to eat them with.
Mm.
I mean, all kinds of things that have nothing to do with how good the pill is, as David was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors know to ask those questions now. And that horrible story where the patient is blamed, that's not going to be happening.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. We are this hour talking about inspirational medicine, really, that seems to be growing, which is also inspirational in this country. PBS presenting RX, The Quiet Revolution, which airs this Thursday night. And the director, producer, award-winning director of the film is with us, as is one of the doctors who has been providing care for the community of Belfast, Maine for some 30 years now, and just the kind of doctor you'd want to have in the kind of practice you would want to have. David Grubin is with us. David has been a director, writer, producer, and cinematographer with over 100 films in all kinds of areas, art, history, poetry, science. He's won all kinds of awards, the Alfred DuPont Award, 3 Peabody Awards, 5 Writers Guild Awards, 10 Emmys, and has done biographies for the American Experience series and just quite a career. Also with quite a career is Dr. David Luxterkamp, and he is in Belfast, Maine, and is quite a doctor. So That's what we're talking about this hour. But the film just doesn't look at Belfast, Maine. It also looks at Chinatown and this remarkable program to keep elderly Chinese in their homes where they want to be. It looks at a complete change in the healthcare system in Alaska, and it goes to the Mississippi Delta where the rate of diabetes is very high and where they're treating it with a really intensive model that is working. So, here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter. We're all over. That's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls. Forrest in Thorpe is next. Hi, Forrest.
It's actually Corey.
It's Corey. Hi, Corey.
Hello. I just wanted to kind of bring up a different viewpoint. It's coming more from the EMS side of care. I'm a licensed paramedic, haven't got a job with it yet because most places require 3 months experience, and, you know, it's impossible for new graduates to get that experience, so I've just been sitting up. But I am involved in a local fire department, been on that for 6 years, but primarily when I did my internship through school and a lot of interactions with the ER staff, I find a lot of, I guess you want to call it patient abuse when it comes to quote-unquote drug seekers, to where, you know, it's like whether the, you know, paramedic ambulance or the ER staff will identify this individual as being a drug abuser. It's, they completely change the level of care and the respect towards that patient. And there was this one instance, and this wasn't a drug seeker case, but we got a call for a car accident, and they thought the lady was fake. And anyways, I was running the call. I was able to give drug meds. Come to find out later on that the lady actually had a broken leg, but they wouldn't have gave her treatment because they thought that she was faking it, just seeking, you know, substance. So I guess I'll just take your thoughts off the air from that.
All right. Thanks for the call. Dr. Lesterkamp.
Well, it is quite a problem. Drug and abuse, and especially opioid abuse, in rural Maine as well as around the country.
Mm-hmm.
I think we always have to be careful about imputing motives to others before we get to know them. One of the great things in the state of Maine, I hope it's also functional in Wisconsin, is a prescription monitoring program so that we can actually look up when a patient comes in, where else they've been going to seek their care, and what other prescriptions they've received. We also have the capacity to do a drug screen. You know, one has to make decisions based on fact and not bias. Our whole approach in Belfast has been to try to help those with a drug abuse problem rather than brand them and turn them away. Again, I think the beauty of living in a small community is that we can see these young people as our own and not as the other. And whether this is a person coming in significant pain for whom we have to make a decision about offering pain, I think in the emergency department, the role is to relieve suffering. In terms of long-term management, that's really the primary care physician's responsibility, and that's where things like a prescription monitoring program and drug screening and then getting these people whatever help they need, whether it is treatment for drug abuse or, in fact, they have legitimate pain for which short-term narcotics are useful and long-term therapy is more appropriate.
Mm. Thank you for that great answer. And speaking of drugs, pharmacies just reminded me of something that I wanted you to talk about, David Grubin, and that's how people are getting health care, and we go to Alaska for this story, in very, very, very remote parts of that state, because a lot of the state is barely accessible. I found the whole dispensary via these electronic things to be interesting, and people who are not doctors but who are in touch with doctors who are in these tiny, tiny communities. Can you talk about that a bit?
It was amazing to fly in to a tiny community. I think there was like 300 people in the place that we went. These places are not connected by roads anywhere. There are rivers, but it's mainly airplanes that do it. And you're not going to find a doctor in these communities. And what they've done in this South Central Foundation, which is the name of this healthcare system, is they take local people and they train them as community health aides with a very, very specific protocol that they follow. And they have a book. It's a big, fat book. And they look things up. They go through the protocol. And then they can call a doctor in Anchorage. They can get them on the phone or they can get them on video. They can put the patient in front of the video. They can have direct conversation with them that way. And between the two of them, the community health aide and the doctor in Anchorage, they can get a lot done.
Right,
If it's something serious, some kind of operation or trauma, they do fly them out. They fly them to Anchorage. If you want to have, if you need specific drugs, they are, aware. They don't have pharmacies in these towns, but they have these very elaborate dispensary. They look like a Coke machine, except they're bulletproof. You know, they don't want anybody breaking into them. And the pharmacist back in Anchorage write the prescription, and they push a button, and out comes what's needed in this little town. So they figured out a way to be in touch with people all over the state. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Pretty neat. Marilyn is our next caller in Madison. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I have a couple of family members who work in family medicine, so I was really paying attention. I would like to say that rural doctors do not grow by magic, and I hope that our state legislators will repair the cuts to the state of Wisconsin program to increase the number of rural doctors.
I would imagine you have a pretty good sense, David Grubin, of what states are doing in terms of reaching out to underpopulated areas.
Well, honestly, I didn't focus on that, and I agree with the caller. I mean, these things are really important because it's up to the policymakers to provide the opportunities for doctors and healthcare people to do their work.
Mm-hmm.
But I really focus in the film on what that work could be and what it is, and then, as I said, policy comes out of that. If you see what these doctors need to function well, then you provide them with the kind of care they need to do that. And you don't say, well, is it Obamacare or is it this or is it that? You don't put a political label on it. You just look at it and say, this is working. How do we keep it working?
Mm-hmm. Megan sends this email. She's a registered nurse and says the comprehensive health care program that's been so successful in Chinatown in California and in-home services was the model used for a PACE program in Milwaukee, which is part of the family care program that the governor wants to tinker with so that a large insurance company from out of state would have to administer it. PACE program, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I would imagine. Yeah, go ahead.
I should say that the PACE program was founded in San Francisco ONLOC group that I profiled. So ONLOC is part now of PACE Lifeways, and there are a number of these all over the country.
Thank you, Megan, for your call. We have time for one more phone call. It has to be quick, though. Lynn in Madison. Hi.
Hi. It's probably got a little cynical twinge to it, but I've worked in healthcare all my professional life, and the primary driver for physicians' behavior has always been money.
Dr. Loxner-Camp, it doesn't sound like that's true for you, though.
Unfortunately, because we come out of medical school and residency with large loans, money is a concern. How do we pay it back? And I think incentives to make those loans less for people going to rural areas or medically underserved areas would be a great help to those who want to practice in rural areas but feel that they have to go into a subspecialty to afford to pay off their loan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call. Well, the film is so worthwhile. I highly recommend it. Thank you for being with us. And David and David, thank you for Thank you for being with us. You're inspirational guys.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, our thanks to you, David Grubin. He's the filmmaker of the film that you really should see. It really is inspirational. It's going to be on PBS on April 1st. He's won all kinds of awards for his work. And Dr. David Loxterkamp, who starts the film on his way to see a patient, riding his scooter with his bow tie. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for your calls, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock, so I hope you'll listen.